The lights are on red. We're away.
Hello, and welcome to MotoGPOD, the internet radio show about motorcycle road racing. Today is Friday, February 6th, 2009, and this is episode number 163. I am Bob Hayes, your host, here today to bring you all kinds of good stuff about MotoGP. We have a super really cool long call today that we did with Jules, so we're going to jump right into that here in just a half a second. We're finishing up almost on the back stretch, if you will, of our 2008 season review. So we're covering the races at Laguna Seca, the U.S. Round of MotoGP, and then the Czechoslovakian round at Brno, San Marino round at Misano, and the second U.S. round at Indianapolis. So we're talking about all four of those races. As you will know, if you watched MotoGP in 2008, there were some big races in that. Plus, on top of that, Jules and I went to both of them. So because of the both of the U.S. rounds. So because we went to Laguna Seca and Indy, we kind of have a lot to talk about. So the call runs rather long. So I am going to jump right into that without a whole lot of further ado, because we really don't have a whole lot of other administrative notes and stuff. So why don't I quit blathering on and just jump right on into that. All right. Hey, Jules, how you doing?
I'm fine. How are you?
Oh, I'm doing good. Doing good. Long week. I just had jury duty today, like we were talking about a little bit of a... Yeah. So that was exciting. Doing my civic duty. Duty. D-O-O-D-Y. But... So, whatever. Let's talk about motorcycle racing. So,
okay. We got a little bit of news I think we should mention. The MotoGP guys are in Sepang right now for the first of the tests, and Kawasaki's not there.
Yes, so they must have been able to get a refund on their track fees or something, you think?
Well,
whatever. managed to cancel the plane tickets in time, something.
Yeah, yeah. Exactly.
A
$25 cancellation fee.
yeah, exactly. Drives the nail in the coffin of any hopes of something coming along with Kawasaki. And I hadn't really thought that there was much. Anyways, it doesn't seem like anybody is interested in racing Kawasaki's as a non-factory effort, except Dorna.
Right.
You know,
right.
I mean, so, you know, when even Kawasaki doesn't want to do it, it's like, yeah, we don't want to go out there and get humiliated.
Yeah.
What are you talking about? Yeah. So... It's a shame. I hope that the will be back sort of tone that they had on the official announcement, I really hope that does pan out, and that, you know, that they can, once the economy kind of turns around, they start selling more motorcycles and ships and things like that Kawasaki makes, that they'll be able to come back.
Definitely. I mean, you know, it's not just the fact that we're losing two bikes on the grid. It's also that this is bound to, you know, have like a domino effect where other factories start to reevaluate their position and their finances, and their stockholders might demand the same kind of... I mean, these are all public companies, so they do have to fall to the will of the stockholders at some point. And, you know, I think that for all these guys except Ducati, the racing effort is really a small part of... such a tiny part of their budget... That it's more of a symbolic move than an actual, you know, save the company type of move. It's not gonna. I mean, if they're struggling in a really bad way, this is not gonna change the struggle.
Right,
but
I agree.
It's very symbolic, you know, and it's. I think it's important for some of them to show that kind of commitment to trying to save the company, I guess.
Sure. I mean, you know, realistically, in some ways, you could kind of compare it to the banks over here that have gotten these billions of dollars in bailout money and yet continue to pay these huge bonuses to the CEOs and whatnot. And the thing is that money that they pay to these CEOs and stuff is not going to make or break the bank. You know what I'm saying? I think it's crap. Those CEOs should not get that much money for driving this bank into the ground. No, sure. but it's not like, wow, you guys just took the last quarter out of the machine and now the bank's done, you know, or something like that.
And
the same is true of this Kawasaki thing. I agree that it is largely symbolic. You know, yeah, they have to cut costs somewhere and everything. But like with Honda pulling out of Formula One, you know, they saved a significant amount of money and all of that. But they're losing a lot of money.
Yeah, you figure that that money probably saved, you know, a lot of jobs. I mean, if you think about how much a MotoGP effort, Formula One is, you know, 10 times MotoGP cost. So, you know, we're talking probably like, you know, 10,000 jobs saved because of that. Well, I don't know, maybe 1,000 jobs saved. Oh, probably like 10,000 jobs for pulling out of Formula One. So
Formula One, yeah, I wouldn't be surprised. I mean, exactly. And granted, the guys in Kawasaki's case of MotoGP, you know, you've got the mechanics and the riders and the team manager and the hospitality people, all the people that make up a MotoGP team no longer have jobs.
Yeah.
But we actually talked about that a lot of these guys can, or we hope, land on their feet elsewhere, that there might be room for them. You know, it's for Hopper, it's not looking too good. But
no, and Melanger too. Melanger, I think, has given up on this.
Yeah.
I actually had an interesting conversation with a buddy of mine who is a very big Melanger fan. And we were talking about the fact that Melanger seems, he's a very talented writer, but he also gives up really easily. I think he, even in the 250s, I remember there was a couple of times where, like, if he wasn't leading the race, he kind of just figured in the middle. And definitely with Ducati, he was just, I mean, I think he was, I think he tried genuinely at the beginning of every weekend, but his confidence was so shot, and he'd get his leg over that thing on a Friday, and by the end of the first session, he was already just, you know,
discouraged.
In despair.
Yeah.
Much more than discouraged. I think he was already in total despair. And I think he is already giving up on this year. I think he's already given up on getting a ride this year. Well, we'll see. I mean, I think he needs to get out of his Kawasaki contract to be able to ride for somebody else. So there's he gets out of the contract and doesn't get paid and can go look for other, you know, other rides. So we'll see what happens with that.
Yeah. Well, all right. So that's enough depressing news. Why don't we?
Well, there was thing that Darren sent that I thought was just so bizarre about the Rossi changing the blinds thing. Did you read that?
Yes.
Rossi had a little accident at home where I can imagine that, you know, knowing how much money Rossi makes, he probably, his ceilings and stuff are probably like, you know, 50 feet tall. And he's closing his blinds probably off like a crane or something. And he fell off into a glass table and actually got cuts enough to on his, what was it, his hand and his foot, right?
Hand and his foot, yeah.
So he has to get stitches. And I love Darren's comment to it because he was like, I think Rossi's safer on the track than he is at his own home.
Needs to hire. Why the hell wasn't Uccio closing those blinds?
Right.
I think that sounds like crap. I mean, I'm not denying that he's cut it. He's cut his hand and his foot badly enough for knee stitches. And he probably even did it on some kind of glass table or something like that. But I just the whole closing the blinds thing.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I think there's a little bubbly somewhere.
Yeah,
there's something a little more serious.
Yeah. Right, it was more like some kind of contraption that hangs from the ceiling broke. Or
very nice. It kind of reminds me of the Hopkins bruised ribs story from last year.
Yeah,
which is actually kind of, there was a lot of rumors about how this ribs came to be bruised. So,
right, exactly. And
it was a kind of funny story. It's kind of a pain because he has to get on the bike with, you know, stitches, which are very painful.
Right, right. And you know, hands can be swollen up and all of that, and foot. So you got to worry about getting the gloves and the boots on and all of that. So in any case, did you see? I mean, have we heard anything about that? Is more on that other than that one quick press release?
No, I haven't.
Yeah, I think it's probably – I'm almost surprised they did a press release about it at all, to be honest with you. Excuse me.
They're pretty soon they're going to be doing press releases when Rossi takes a crap, so –
You know. Yeah, I suppose, because he is MotoGP. Yeah. So, all right. Well, we were thinking that this might be a long show because we're talking about four races and four pretty good ones at that. Yeah. Certainly, I'd say one of the most spectacular races we've had in years, and another one that was extremely eventful, and actually, they were all pretty good. So,
and we were at two of these, so... That's going to make it extra long. We're going to have all this, whatever. So I've been trying to figure out like what to call this segment, and I think tying loose ends kind of came up because Rossi won during this four race span. He won at three tracks that he's never won at before.
That's true.
He never won at Laguna. He's never won at Misano, and he's never won at Indy because Indy was never in the schedule before, but. I don't know, but it was also, I think, what wrapped up the championship because so kind of loose ends kind of makes sense, right? He wrapped it up too. So, I mean, he didn't really officially wrap it up, but it was like a, you know, everybody knew that it was over by the end of this four race series.
Yeah. Barring disaster. Yeah, pretty much. I mean, I was still, you know, doing the rah-rah thing that, hey, it's not over till it's over. But, yeah, it was all but over. Okay. So, all right. So, Laguna Seca.
Right.
Since we get a chance to go, and let's see. I've been to three of them MotoGPs at Laguna Seca now, and I guess you've been to four, right?
Yep. I've been going every year, and I've been going to, you know, the Superbikes before that, so.
Yeah. Yeah, never went to Superbikes. Did you... Now, way back when did they stop racing there? Was it 91, 92?
No, I wasn't in California yet.
Even in California? Yeah, okay, yeah. Still in there. Back east, yeah. And I was not into it and all of that. I didn't even realize that they had it. Otherwise, probably would have gone. But, whatever. So in the modern era, if you want to call that, of MotoGP at Laguna Seca, yes, we've been doing pretty good. And so that, you know, means it has kind of a special spot in my heart, so to speak.
It's a racetrack that has so much character. And talk about, you know, when you talk about like racetracks like Mugello and nestled in the Tuscany Hills and all that kind of stuff, this track also has the location is really interesting and the layout is very unique. It's one of the most unique racetracks, and of course it has one of the most famous corners in all of racing, both two and four wheel.
And for a MotoGP. As far as the MotoGP calendar is concerned, this racetrack is the track itself is relatively, you know, it's very old school, not as safetied out as many of the newer races.
Racetracks. Although I have to say that since MotoGP has been going there, unbelievable great job by the owners of that track to. And actually, also Yamaha put in a lot of money to upgrade both the safety and just make the whole event run a lot smoother. Because 2005 was pretty brutal, but by 2006 they had it really figured out nicely. And even though we had like the really hot year and the kind of goofy year last year was almost cold for California, it's kind of odd I think that it's a super facility. It's definitely not like, I mean, it feels like old school. I mean, the paddock is interesting because we've talked about this many times on the show, is that if you want to meet racers and crews, this is the place to go to see a race because by having access to the paddock, there's no way that the crews can get to and from their trucks and stuff, their motorhomes and whatever, without crossing through the like a public area. So it's a really unique opportunity to be able to like, you know, meet the riders and talk to the crews and stuff. It's
right.
It's
unless you happen to have some kind of connection to be able to get the great passes at the regular tracks. You know, at Laguna Seca, you can simply buy one. It's extra $50.
Yep.
You know, for a paddock pass, and so anybody, you don't have to have any connections or anything like that, but anybody can get there. And if you have enough patience and all of that, you know, you can be. You can get Rossi's autograph or whatever, as you can attest to. You had had an autograph. You finally got an autograph. And what did Lee got his helmet autographed by Colin Edwards. And, and I mean, just all kinds of great stuff. So that's Lee Lipinski, by the way, friend of MotoGPOD. We had a great time down there last year. We really did. It was a good one. And I'm looking forward to a good time this year.
Yeah, definitely.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
So I hope you don't have to dig out any cars.
Yeah. Right, so. Yeah.
So yeah, so I love the atmosphere there, and I'm always going to go to this racetrack. But I never expected. I never expect a great race there because we had, fairly processional races. 2006 was a good race for about 10 laps, with Kenny Roberts kind of figuring up front. Then we had the. Of course, Nicky Hayden won again because he won the 2005 race. We had the Pedrosa did well first time out at Laguna Seca. It was an interesting race, but still, it was kind of decided early. 2007 was a complete blowout by Stoner. I don't think there was even a battle up to fifth or sixth position. So you kind of go there for the atmosphere and to hear the bikes go around and around and scream for your favorite rider, but not expect to see what we saw this year, which was epic.
A phenomenal
just
race.
Epic.
That will be remembered for a long time. And I think, this will be in the replays and all of that kind of thing. It was jumping up and down, going nutso, great race.
It's a 32 lap race, and we got. 24 laps.
24?
We got 24 laps of just madness. And, people say, there hasn't been a race that has been won on the last lap. Well, this race had to end the way it did. Something had to give. It was amazing that these guys lasted 24 laps as the way they were racing. Of course, we're talking about Valentino Rossi and Casey Stoner.
Right.
So
let's
get into it. I mean, basically,
let's get into it. Yeah.
Stoner completely. Owned the proceedings.
All the practice
right from
sessions.
The beginning.
Yeah.
Right from the beginning. And this is also the second time that we've had the big Michelin failure. So we covered Sachsenring last week. And now, Michelin arrived and they just were so worried about, because in 2006 and in 2007, there was tire longevity issues. They were so worried about the issue of heat. That they brought all the tires were too hard, and it was so bad that on Friday morning and on Saturday morning, during the free practice sessions 1 and 3, the Michelin riders were out on intermediates, the grooved tires, because that's the only way they could actually get heat into the tire, because all the other tires that Michelin brought were just too hard. Meanwhile, the Bridgestone guys were able to go out on decent tires, decent slicks.
Right.
So from the very beginning was just, oof,
Yeah. And Hayden and even Colin Edwards were both very vocal in their disappointment and unhappiness about this. I mean, Hayden had told Michelin before the race, and Michelin chose not to do a test at Laguna Seca, but Hayden had told him, don't bring the hard stuff. And but they did anyway, and I mean he was disgusted. He made comments in that Repsol event that we went to on Friday, and even Colin Edwards, perennial Michelin rah-rah man, made some made comments. They were not happy. This is the one I think that Michelin really did drop the ball on. Some of the others, it's a little bit sort of a thing. But I think on this one, they should have listened to the guys that know a little bit more, and they should have brought some different stuff.
Right. It wasn't actually quite as big of a failure as Brno in terms of final standings, but the fact that the riders had to contend with these you know, having to ride intermediate tires, which in the dry don't last very long, which means you're constantly coming back into the pits and you don't, you know, you're running out of tires because there's only so many tires you're allowed to use. So I think that they just weren't unprepared. All the teams that were on Michelins were just not prepared enough for race day.
Right.
That was really painful. And Pedrosa, who was hurt, I mean, he did come to the race on Friday, but because the tires were in such bad shape and the conditions were iffy, he ended up pulling out. And I actually believe he flew out on Friday evening or Saturday morning.
I think he did. Yeah, he wasn't there at all on Saturday. He's, you know, he's either leaving on the plane early Saturday morning or Friday evening because right. he didn't come out. He did both practice sessions on Friday, though, right?
I think he correctly. Only did one.
Did he only do one?
I don't remember exactly, yeah. but
I can't recall either. But yeah, basically, because he was hurt, he didn't want to aggravate those injuries and all of that, and he knew that he had no chance of decent results. He bailed on it.
Well, like we mentioned in the last show, Michelin actually has a very good qualifier, so qualifying kind of hid the problem again, because we had Hayden on the front row. We had Lorenzo on the second. Toslin was in the second row. Depugne was on second row. You know, then there was Edwards. It was basically just Stoner and Rossi up there on Bridgestones. And then the next Bridgestone was eighth, Vermeulen. So, you know, this is the kind of thing that I think qualifying kind of hides. And I'm kind of excited about no qualifying tires, even though I agree with you that there was this nice like little tire war thing. But of course, now that we have a single tire, that doesn't matter anyway. But I think this is it can really hide the reality, because it looked like these guys were competitive, but in reality, they just weren't.
Right, they were competitive for one lap, you know, the fast laps and things like that. Right, and the thing is, and my point on that is, although it may not necessarily always be the safest thing, it tends to make things a little more interesting. And we talked about inverted grids a show or two ago. And all of that. You're going to get a lot more passing when you have the slow guys start in front.
Sure.
But you're right. That's somewhat artificial and shallow, and also is somewhat unsafe. But if you have just a strict qualifying, you know, fastest guys in front and on down to the slowest guy and this and that, then you're losing a lot of opportunities for passing.
Yep, exactly. So,
but in any case, you're right that this particular race, we did have somewhat of that, of kind of a false grid, if you want to call it that.
I think, you know, it happened a lot this season, but it was very pronounced here because Michelin was anybody on Michelin was really struggling during practice, and it was only during the qualifying where they seemed to do okay. And I think people who don't really understand the difference between, like, just a casual fan was just like, oh, whatever, Michelin, Bridgestone, whatever. There's Mickey Hayden, he's on the front row.
Right.
And you know, speaking of the front row, I think this Rossi said before the race. Actually, it was after Saxon, when he started talking about the fact that his team has to work on better qualifying, because the only way he can hope to race Stoner, who had completely, you know, dominated the previous three rounds, that he has to start next to Stoner.
Right. Right, you know, he has to be on the front row, and he has to get a good start.
Has to get a good start, also exactly.
Right,
be near Stoner on the first corner, and
exactly,
and then he thinks he has a fighting chance.
Exactly, but, and Rossi has always been it starts, you know, up to this point in the season at least, and in previous years, is never really all that necessarily great of a starter, because he knew he could make it up.
Exactly.
And qualifying wise, you know, a little bit hot and cold. Oftentimes, Rossi's on the front row, but sometimes he's not, you know,
right.
That kind of thing. You know.
Yeah. So I think he, you know, it was looking pretty bad for him. I mean, Stoner was wasn't really just, you know, faster than anybody. He was just
dominating.
Faster.
It was
like second.
Bad.
Yeah. You know, faster.
I was getting somewhat discouraged of how the race would be, because, you know, all weekend long it looks like, well, it's just going to be another Stoner runaway,
right.
and it's kind of like, well, let's
everybody
just
was expecting
the
it. Everybody was just looking at who's going to get take second place and how many points is Stoner going to get on Rossi in this race, you know, to catch him in the championship and all that kind of stuff. I mean, nobody was talking about anything other than, you know, what was going to happen behind Stoner, but that's not what happened.
Exactly.
We had a start, which actually Nicky Hayden led to the first corner, but then immediately Stoner took over, And by the fourth corner, he was like, I don't know, like 7/10 of a second ahead of everybody. It was looked already like, okay, well, here we go. And in fact, we got distracted by at the fifth corner, we got distracted by that incredibly nasty Lorenzo high side.
Yes, reminiscent of
China.
China. Yeah, the star shaped sort of cartwheel through the gravel.
Oh, just really,
it was brutal.
Brutal.
It was ugly.
Brutal.
Yeah,
very,
I mean,
ugly.
I saw it because I was in the turn four grandstands, and you can just see. You know, so you sort of knew something had happened. You couldn't see a lot of details because you got the jumbotron right in front of you, though, and you're watching that, and it's like, oh, my God, that was an awful wreck, you know?
And I think every single commentary, because we've watched them all like a million times now, I can probably like recite like the entire Eurosport one lap by lap. But they were also still talking about that they didn't notice that by the time the bikes ended up at the top of this corkscrew, Rossi was ahead. And This is the strategy that Rossi knew he had to do. He knew that, first of all, that Stoner was fastest in the last section of the track, the T4, or I4, I mean. And he knew he had to be ahead of him there. And he also knew that Stoner would have better speed through over that quote-unquote straight. So he knew that he had to be in front of Stoner at the bottom of the corkscrew and at turn 11. And I think he also knew that he had to be in front of Stoner going uphill.
Yeah.
He had to enter at least turn 6. Through turn 5, turn 6, he had to be on Stoner. If any of those points, which is a lot of points, over 32 laps, if any of those points, I think if Stoner was able to get in front of Rossi, I think he would have been able to pull that little itty-bitty lead that would have been able to get him to shake Rossi off of him. He would have been relaxed then. He would have been able to get his rhythm, and he would have been gone.
Right.
But Rossi never, ever let him. I mean, that's the most amazing thing is that coming out of the corkscrew, Stoner never led.
No, exactly. And I mean, and one of those passes, the famous pass in the gravel there where the gravel has a great grip,
right.
you know, I mean, Rossi was pushing.
Yeah, yeah. He knew that right there, that lap, he knew that Stoner was going to get away from him if he didn't do something drastic. I don't think he meant to go through the gravel. I think he just basically like took a very, very aggressive line.
Right.
And ended up in the gravel. And there's an incredible photograph by Andrew Wheeler, who's been on the show before, and he's a good friend of ours. And he has a fantastic photo of just how bottomed out the suspension on the M1 was when Rossi hit the bottom of the corkscrew to come back out onto the track.
I don't think I've seen that.
Oh man, I'll send you a link because I think that everybody should see this photo. It just really captures how incredibly skilled/lucky Rossi is, but you know, he's been lucky so many times that
you make your own luck.
Yeah, he's making his own luck, and also just how incredible these motorcycles are. I mean, it's the thing looks like a lowrider, you know.
Yeah, I'd like to see that picture. Let's put a link to that. Send me the link and we'll put it in the show notes on MotoGPOD.com.
Right. That was on lap four, by which point already we were all, you know, at the racetrack, you don't get to see it. I didn't get to see this except on the jumbotrons. And I was also photographing the event, so I was looking more at like turn 9, turn 10, turn 11, because I was in those Honda stands there. And, you know, you hear it, though. Like, and every time he was coming, every time they came around that corner, turn 9, Stoner was just glued to Rossi's rear, and it was just, you know, heart racing for all the fans, and for anybody who was in a corkscrew. I envy you for those laps. I did end up going to the corkscrew for the final, I don't know, 4 or 5 laps, but of course by that point the race was over. So
you have to watch some of the on track action from the corkscrew, but let's face facts. The view's pretty crappy. There's no jumbotron.
Yeah.
You only see a brief, you know, moment of bikes going by, zoom, 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 and then, you know, a little bit of nothing. But yeah, it is spectacular to see. And if you go to Laguna Seca, you must see at least a practice session in the Corkscrew.
Yeah, it's really something else.
It is.
It was already building up to that point, because each lap, even before that, it was just getting crazier and crazier. And if you listen to all the, like, we did that great Pepsi challenge. You did that great Pepsi challenge last year.
For the announcers,
we were covering it, of the announcers. And, like, everybody was pretty much screaming. And this is four laps into the race. And then we had 20 more of this kind of racing. Just unbelievable stuff. You know, we could spend, two or three shows discussing every single lap. So let's not. Let's just talk about the fact that on the beginning of the 24th lap, there was a couple of times where Stoner led the race. Obviously, that's what made it so even more exciting. Is there was plenty of times over the straight that he led the race, and also up the hill in the towards the Corkscrew, he led by, like, a half a wheel.
Right, and he led one lap officially, lap 13.
Right, because he crossed the line before Rossi.
He crossed the line,
but that was
officially.
Rossi was always out of the corner at 11 first. That was very critical. And Randy Mamola was commenting on how much better the Yamaha was in acceleration, just those first few meters, than the Ducati. And that was really buying Rossi that opportunity to kind of dictate the pace throughout the entire race. Which he did. I mean, that was what it was all about. He was dictating the pace. But it also has to be said that somehow they did manage to get that bike to go a lot faster than it. I think it took everybody by surprise, including Rossi to some degree.
Yeah, they did something.
Yeah, they did something during warm-up. They found something that gave them – because they were really behind. I mean, they were really off pace from Stoner.
And a part of that might have been sandbagging through the practice session, but I don't think it was all sandbagging. It couldn't have all been sandbagging.
I mean, if you're trying to put pressure on somebody who is so hard to put pressure on, like Stoner, you might as well start early. So, if Rossi could have shown, I guess it goes both ways. You could say that if he's shown real speed close to Stoner's early on during practice, then Stoner would have been ready for it. And I think that it did take him by surprise. I'm sure Stoner was really surprised.
Sure, took me by surprise.
He was coming out of turn six and there was Rossi right next to him. So anyway, we had 24 of these unbelievable laps. Harkening back to Stoner, I mean to Rossi Gibber nowadays, but really I don't remember any race being this intense, because the thing about Laguna Seca is that there is no place where you can just rest and hang out behind somebody and just... and think about your strategy. It's just really just constant battle at every single corner. But on the beginning of the 24th lap, Stoner got advantage, and Chaz Davies, who was commentating, I think, for BBC. He was helping with the BBC guys.
Yeah.
He was talking about this almost from the very beginning. He was saying that Stoner is very strong in turn three, very strong in turn three, very strong in turn three, and sure enough, on that 24th lap, Stoner, who had often had an advantage going over the straight but lost it by turn three, snuck in under Rossi. And Rossi did, like, I think this was the real turning point of the race, was that Rossi somehow managed to get on the outside of Stoner and pass him on turn four. It was a totally audacious, ridiculous, nobody else would have tried it kind of move.
Right,
but it paid off. He got in front of Stoner again, and they went around the lap, and at turn 11 is where Stoner fell.
Right, and there was the accusation from Stoner that Rossi had brake checked him and this and that.
Well, actually, has he ever actually said that? I thought that it was basically that a lot of journos were asking him. So, did you think that Rossi brake checked him? And
was it? I thought he did say that.
I don't think he ever said it. I think Stoner, the only thing he said was, like, I don't know what that was, but all I know is that I've been racing for, most of my life, and I've never and some of his moves were just too much. It was too aggressive.
Yes, he did. He was, and this was the race where we shook the unshakable Casey Stoner. You know, where the Rossi's mind games and all of that stuff has never worked on Stoner, but it did work at this race.
Yes,
he got Stoner upset,
and you could tell because Stoner dropped his guard. I mean. You can't fault the guy, and he didn't apologize, but he definitely explained himself at Brno, saying, you know, in the heat of the moment, all that kind of stuff. But he exposed himself, and Rossi must have been like, "Oh yeah, I have you now, buddy."
Yes, I have because, you.
Because you know that BBC interview afterwards was amazing.
That was awesome.
It was amazing. Yes, that was funny. And like,
I can't remember exactly the wording and stuff, but it was fantastic.
You know, this is racing. This is racing, right. Casey. Oh, this is racing. We'll see. And then, you know, Matthew Roberts was asking Stoner about what he think what happened. Stoner was saying it was way too aggressive. He's never seen anything like it. It was too dangerous. It was too much. Blah blah blah. And then they go. One of my favorite moments of watching Rossi was when Roberts talks to Rossi and says, "Well, so what do you think about? So what's your side of the story?" And then Rossi goes. About what?
Yeah.
This really big smile.
Just another day at the office for Valentino.
It was a good race.
Yeah. But it was such an exciting race. And I mean, when Stoner went down, he drops the bike in the gravel trap, and it was almost a comedy kind of fall.
The fall.
Because he's in the gravel trap, and he's basically at this point going very, very slow, and he just sort of falls over.
It kind of reminds me of Barros at maybe it was Catalonia, like in 2003 or 2004 when he was turning his bike around. Do you remember? Does this ring a bell for you?
Yeah, it does actually.
Barros turning around and dropping the bike while he's maneuvering it. Kind of like garage drop.
By the time the bike actually fell over, Stoner was almost stopped, and it was like the garage drop.
And I think he was basically looking. He was looking down the straight. He wasn't looking at the surface, which changes because the very outside of the corner is hard gravel, but then it gets soft, so that anybody going too fast. But basically, anybody who just misses the corner can get back on the track. But if you go too far, then you're going too fast, and you need to be stopped. So it gets very soft, and he was looking down to see where Rossi was because he was so concentrated. He's a great racer. He's looking down where he's going to go next, and missed the fact that he actually went into the deeper gravel and just dropped it. Got back on the track and still managed to finish in second position.
He was still like many seconds ahead of Christopher Mullin.
Was in
by
third.
The time that he actually got back on the track.
If Stoner had not been able to get the bike up, it would have been the biggest victory margin ever in GP racing.
Really?
Yeah, it would have been 26 seconds.
Yeah.
From Vermeulen. But it didn't happen. Obviously, Stoner did get the bike up and managed to finish second. So really, like... That could have happened if they had gone on the full 32 laps and Stoner lost by a wheel. He only lost the 5 points. So it's just remarkable. These guys were just so far ahead of the field that a guy could actually fall down, pick up his bike, and still finish second.
Right. Exactly. And by such a large margin.
Yeah.
Too, as well. It was a spectacular weekend. And we've kind of spent a lot of time on it.
So at this point, Rossi, because Pedrosa didn't race,
right.
And he had the crash in the Saxon ring, we now had Stoner building a lead over Pedrosa. He took over second place,
right?
And he was 16 points ahead. So that's a third place. So
it's pretty starting to get significant when you only have 7 remaining races. You know that it's a considerable point margin. And one thing we didn't mention was that Hopkins wasn't here at all that weekend.
Hopkins missed it because of the broken leg he suffered at Saxon Ring. Assen.
And I think that was a big disappointment for him because all of the Americans, Laguna Seca is a bit of a, you know, they really want to do well.
Definitely.
And so, yeah, that was...
And because Lorenzo didn't finish, you know, he was way now behind. He was pretty much out of the running at this point, although he did have some great racing remaining. But this was, I think, his third non-finish. So,
Divizioso
also has to get big, big thumbs up because first time at the track and he was fourth. And he was the first Michelin.
Yes, that is true. And that was some good racing going on there, too, with
him and Hayden
and Divizioso.
Yep.
Yeah. No, it was a great weekend. It really was. That was well worth the price of admission for that one.
Oh, yeah. And we should also mention that Ben Spies did race here and finished a very decent eighth.
Right.
He did get pipped by Elias delight of guys like Liam.
And Elias.
And Elias, of course.
Yes.
Anyway, it was a fantastic weekend. I'm going to treasure that, the fact that I was there, you know, for many years.
Right. Now you have the
next great one.
you have the Duke MotoGP review DVD for this year?
No, I didn't bother getting it this
year. Haven't got it yet? No. Okay, because I was wondering the coverage on Laguna Seca because I haven't seen it yet either.
It's probably like, you know, 90% of the DVD.
Yeah, exactly. it was the best race of the season as far as, you know, if you, and I said this at the time, that if, you know, if you've got a friend that has never watched MotoGP and you're trying to sort of, you know, hey, look, this is a cool sport and all that, this is the race you show them.
Right.
Because, of course, you
show them this race and then everything else just pales, so.
It does, unfortunately, yes, but, you know, but once you set the hook.
You promised me sparks. You promised me fireworks, Bob.
I know. But, yeah, and it was awesome stuff. So then we moved on to
Czechoslovakia. Well, then we had the big break.
Yes, we had the big summer break, which is always a little painful.
Yeah, I mean, I think a lot of people were really looking forward to this break. We had Pedrosa, who was hurt, Hopkins, who was hurt. We had... the whole Michelin fiasco was now in full swing. And, of course, everybody was expecting that everything would be fixed by Brno, which was not the case, as we'll talk momentarily. But
And the break was actually a little shorter than it has been in years past.
That's true. It was under four weeks.
Yeah.
I think the saddest thing that happened during this time was that Hayden broke his heel while doing X Games motocross training or something like that, or supermoto was it?
It was supermoto. It was it was the X Games, the supermoto race at the X Games,
right?
And Hayden got convinced by a humongous paycheck to go do the supermoto race, and.
He loves the supermoto stuff.
Yes,
he's been doing it for a long time. Not necessarily in the X Games, but I remember there was like him and Biaggi racing around in Southern California.
Well, I think it appeals to his dirt tracking side.
Exactly. It's
and
perfect.
You know, it is. It's a supermoto is neat stuff. I can't say that I'm, a humongous fan or anything like that. I don't follow the series and go nutso and all that about various different supermoto races all over the place. But it's entertaining to watch. It's more of a one-off for me. You know, I'll watch a supermoto race and say, wow, this is cool stuff. You know?
Definitely.
But in any case, yeah, so Hayden broke his heel, right?
His heel, which is a really nasty thing to break because there's absolutely no way to set it. You basically, it's kind of like a collarbone or a rib. You just accept it's on your foot. So you're constantly messing with it.
Right. You know. Makes walking difficult, makes riding a motorcycle difficult, and it makes life difficult.
Yeah.
And I think Nicky Hayden is the poster child for broken heels. So we went to Brno.
So we went to Brno, and again, Stoner was very fast, but this time he wasn't. Yamaha had brought new bits, and they were definitely doing much better. what was, I think, interesting, was this the race that Nakano, yeah, I think Nakano got to ride the factory spec pneumatic valve Honda. So now there were two on board.
Which was testing it out also with the
with Bridgestones. He was on Bridgestones, right. Obviously, right. Because Tim Grissini has been on Bridgestones the whole season, and which gave birth to a lot of rumors because there was some talk about. Honda, I don't know when the rumors exactly started. I think it was because of that that people started talking about Pedrosa.
It was certainly around then, because I know we were discussing it. This is Honda's test bed. Yeah.
So basically, HRC was considering. I mean, Pedrosa was demanding, or maybe Puig was demanding.
Puig was pulling the puppet strings and talking with it, you know, while drinking a glass of water, and Pedrosa said he wanted Bridgestones. Yeah. It was something like that. Anyway.
Yeah, so I think was it during this race or was it? Yeah, it was at Brno during practice that and again Michelin failed miserably. Everybody was struggling, and it was unexplainable because the temperatures were decent. There was some rain, a little bit of wet, but in general there was nothing out of the extraordinary and. Michelin was just struggling. So I think it was at Brno that Puig tried to stage a boycott. Basically, he was going to all the teams and asking them to not – Michelin teams and asking them not to race, kind of like a what happened in Indy, except, of course, at Indy it was – I'm sorry, at the Indy F1 race in 2005. But, of course, that was – Michelin that pulled all the cars off the grid,
but same similar effect where Michelin riders like Michelin shot the machines. Show right
so we all hate Puig for that,
and that this was also to me such a surprise that Michelin dropped the ball again.
I know
okay, it's like Germany, okay, well everybody makes a mistake once,
right?
Laguna Seca, okay, well you had 2006
by the fact because 2006 they got destroyed by Bridgestone because it was so damn hot.
148 degrees. Yeah. I mean, you know, and but then this one, you know, 4 weeks later, you guys have had two bad weekends.
Get it together. I mean, they didn't bring a wide enough range of tires, or I don't know what, but basically somebody.
I can't remember
really
the details of exactly what went wrong at Brno.
Lack of grip. I don't know.
Well, it's always lack of grip, right?
And, yeah, you know, chatter, whatever you want to call it.
But you know, but like why? Guys. Why? What were they expecting? You know, I don't remember details of like, oh, we thought it was going to be hotter. Oh, we thought, you know, what? I can't remember what that was, and of why Bridgestone screwed it up, excuse me, Michelin screwed it up. But they did.
It was. This was basically the end of. This was the beginnings of the talks of the single tire rule. Which of course did happen, and although Michelin did finish fairly strong, this was really the end.
Yeah, I agree, and it was also I think it was probably the point where Pedrosa finalized. You know that this I want Bridgestones.
Right.
Yeah, this is the reason I'm not winning. It's because of my tires.
Right.
And
right.
Yeah.
I mean, I believe during it was only the next race at Misano. Yeah, it was at Misano, the test after Misano, that Pedrosa was already on Bridgestones by that point. So the ball was definitely rolling.
Yeah, yeah, I agree. And there might have been possibly some political inside dealing sort of a thing of like, you know, we'll hold off, you know, if you guys can get it right or something. Like, I would not be surprised at all if that would have been the case.
Sure.
Yeah.
Okay, so yeah. Anyway, so we had Stoner... on pole position for the sixth time in a row?
I think it was, yeah. It was. I mean, he had a huge number of poles this past year.
But in a row, which I think was a record of some sort. I think it was a mistake that he did the sixth one, unless I missed a race in there somewhere. Anyway, so Stoner was first and Rossi was second. Like he said, well, he had to do, but the big surprise was Hopkins on the Kawasaki, who was
right.
Was terrible. Even in qualifying, they just never had good luck. Third. So he was in the front row for the first time on the Kawasaki. That was great.
Right, came back from an injury and all of that on the Kawasaki, and managed to put it on the front row.
And it wasn't just him, because West was on the second row.
Right. So something about Bruneau was suiting the Kawasaki's, you know, horsepower hill, whatever it is, that they were able to have their best qualifying performance of the season.
And I have to say this thing about Bruneau again that I say every time we talk about Bruneau is, like, if you look at this track layout from the top, like in a 2D, just written on a page,
right,
it looks like the worst track layout ever. It's just like straight S, straight S, straight S, straight S, you know?
Yeah, it is pretty boring.
It looks horrible, but because of the elevation changes, it is one of the coolest tracks. And, you know, I've played it on the PS2, and I've never been there, but I've seen, you know, the footage from many years of watching racing there. And it is a really, really cool racetrack, and I think that a lot of riders really like it because it's so wide.
Right, and supposedly a fantastic place to actually go to a MotoGP event.
Yes, that's right. That's right. A lot of people say that is a great venue to go to.
Yeah, your exchange rate is you don't take quite such a beating that you do, you know, like in England or whatever, where it's just so expensive, or Japan. But you know, so you get more value for your money, and also there's just so many other things about it that it is a very, very good event to go to, and incidentally. Pole Position Travel is based in Czechoslovakia.
So, oh, I didn't know that.
The Czech Republic. The Czech Republic, yes. So, yeah.
Cool.
So, there we go. Quick plug for Gordon Howell over at Pole Position Travel. Check him out, polepositiontravel.com.
Stoner got a great start and looked like it was going to be a runaway, except that Rossi was matching him for the first five laps on pace. What happened actually in this race, I think this race would have been a much closer race, except that because Hopkins was on the front row, and Hopkins had a fantastic start, he actually beat Rossi to the first corner, but then had a little bit of trouble going through the next couple, and Rossi got stuck behind him. And Rossi didn't, I think, pass him until the end of the, just before the end of the lap.
Right. It was looking really good for Hopkins.
But it was looking good for Rossi. Rossi was stuck behind him, and he...
Exactly.
He said after the race that that cost him at least a second off of Stoner's time. So Stoner was about a second and a half ahead at the end of the first lap already. So it looked like another runaway. But as soon as Rossi got past Hopper, he showed that his true pace. And throughout the weekend, as much as Stoner did dominate most of the practice, Rossi was not that far behind, so it looked like it was going to be a good one. And I think that even though 4 weeks have passed since Laguna Seca, there was still some heat boiling and some boiling blood in Stoner. And because basically what happened, I think, is the moment that Rossi cut into Stoner's time, which was on lap six. And Stoner's famous for saying that he likes to watch what's going on in the race by looking at the big jumbotrons.
Yeah.
He saw this. He saw that in just one section of the track, Rossi had gained like 0.2 seconds, and the next one, another 0.1. He upped his pace, whatever. He doesn't know exactly what happened, but on lap seven, he fell, and it was a off camber corner. It's very possible that he actually dragged his
foot peg,
and there was a lot of talk about the fact that because they actually changed the geometry of the bike
a little bit.
He fell, and he was unable to restart.
Well, he did get back out of there, but
he did. He made one more lap, but the bike was just too damaged.
Right, something was broken. There were serious broken bits. Yeah.
So you know, Rossi took the win easily, and it wasn't a super exciting race there anymore. Obviously, but there was some great stuff happening behind him because Elias came through from way back in 13th,
mm-hmm.
and went through just cut through the field. It was really excellent to watch.
It was awesome.
Him.
It was fantastic.
Really, really fantastic and stuff. And they did show us quite a bit of it.
Right. And Liam, talking with Liam and all of that, and their excitement as a team, And the fact that this was, you know, they're really getting into their stride that Dantin was gone.
Right, right.
And so
like,
as a
it's
team,
almost like they just breathed a huge sigh of relief and got to work.
Something like that, yeah. And I mean, you know, I don't know all the politics involved and all of that, but apparently it made a difference for that team. And it was. This was kind of a magical race for them. Best result of the season and all that.
Actually, best result ever for...
ever, yeah.
For that particular squad.
And so yeah, that was kind of cool that he did. It was very, very cool that he finished second and all of that.
Yeah, he cut through the field, got a second. Caparossi got third. And Nakano, I think, was, to me, the biggest surprise. I just did not expect. But basically, it just shows that this, you know, that the Gresini guys really were working with a more difficult bike because they had the spring valve motor.
Right.
And the moment that Nakano is on the fast bike, now granted, you know, there's a lot of confidence involved as well. He's always been pretty good at this track. I think he almost had a podium here on the Kawasaki once. But anyway, he also cuts to the field. I mean, he started
way down, eighth.
No, it's not way.
Not way down.
Elias, but he also. Oh, actually, he was involved in an incident right in the beginning. So he actually, I think, was because on my chart you see him dropping like big time, and then building his lead again. Yeah, he like dropped down to like 12th place, and then had to build it up from there to finish fourth. So that was really cool to see. And then Anthony West finished fifth.
Right, which for him is, you know, should have got a trophy.
I think that was the best finish of his career in MotoGP.
Yeah, bit sad, West. But yeah, interesting race. Always is, like I say, an interesting track, let alone, you know, Horsepower Hill, which off the top of my head, can't remember the British writer that sort of made that term famous, but it's what it is.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
And it's at the end of the race, because we had Stoner didn't finish, so it wasn't a 5-point loss or anything like that. He lost a full 25 points, and suddenly Rossi's ahead by 50. Two race wins, and we're on round 12, so there's only six remaining. So suddenly we went from a pretty close championship to a very nasty-looking lead to try to catch. I mean, the only person who's ever been able to catch that kind of lead this late was actually Rossi in 2006, and he still didn't win the championship. So, he's not going to be finishing eighth or ninth for the rest of the season.
Right. This is the point where you're kind of thinking that the season is about done. Right. You know, it's not done mathematically. It wasn't done mathematically for quite a while, but it's still, realistically, it was pretty much done.
Right. Right.
But still a very good race as far as championship results were concerned. It really made a huge difference in this championship. This particular race.
Definitely, definitely.
Yeah. And, good stuff. What was I going to say here? Because Hopkins, unfortunately, though, from his front row start, only managed to finish 11th.
Yeah, yeah, he didn't do so well. Pedrosa had a horrible time on the Michelins, and I think he finished 15th, so he got a point.
Right.
So his championship was screwed now. I mean, even though Stoner fell, he only gained 1 point on him.
Yeah.
And
Lorenzo qualified last.
What's that?
Lorenzo qualified last at this race.
Right, and he finished 10th, so, you know, not terrible.
Which, he picked up quite a few spots, seven spots.
Mm-hmm. Anyway, Michelin was a mess at this point.
Yeah,
and,
it was.
You know, now that we're going to talk about Misano next, one of the interesting things, I think, was this. So this is the race where it was announced that Pedrosa was going to go to Bridgestones, and after the race he was testing on him. And a very interesting point was made not too long ago. A friend of mine pointed out that with HRC going to Bridgestone, there were no more factory teams riding on Michelins. I never really looked at it that way.
Right.
Because, yeah, sure, that we had Lorenzo. So half of Yamaha factory was running on Michelins and half of
Honda.
HRC was running on Michelins. But basically there were no factories. They were riding on Michelins. So there were no factory, full factory Michelin. So it kind of sealed the deal, you know?
Yeah, I think you're right.
Michelin would have a really tough time developing it. That's probably why they didn't. You know, there was a time when they were putting in charters, I guess, for bids for being the manufacturer. Michelin never even bothered.
Right.
You know,
and I think you're right on that one too. That they sort of had a somewhat of their own give up kind of moment.
Right.
So,
So Misano. Oh, so I do want to point out that the Brno finish, because Casey Stoner fell, and again, Casey and Rossi has such a ridiculous pace advantage over everybody else.
Right.
That this was actually the biggest win margin of the 990 era. Oh, since the 990 four-stroke era.
Was it?
Started, yep.
Yeah, 15 odd seconds from Rossi. But yeah.
And the closest to that was actually Rossi over, was it Biaggi in Australia when he had that 10-second penalty in 93? Was it over Gibernau? I forget over who. It's one of those two guys.
Yeah.
Basically, that was that famous race in Australia where Rossi got yellow flagged.
2003, yeah.
Yeah, and he got yellow flagged and then had to make up 10 seconds, so he did.
Yes.
But that was like 13.2 exactly. Or something like that, and this was 15. So even though it wasn't an exciting way to get that 15 seconds, it is a record.
Yeah, and somewhat significant in its own merit.
Yeah, so, definitely.
Yeah. All right, moving on.
Misano.
We still have two more races, including a big one.
Oh, yeah. So yeah, San Marino, Misano. Let's go through this really quickly because it was kind of a letdown. It was the race that Rossi was looking forward to because it's, 14 clicks from his hometown, something like that?
Right.
And it was one of the tracks that he has never won at. Although, I mean, it's only been in the calendar 2 years, but last year, I mean, the previous year in 2007, he had a engine failure after 5 laps. So he was really keen on winning this one, but it was not looking good, actually, because it wasn't like Brno. Stoner was definitely looking dominant again. But during the race, same thing. It's also in the 7th lap, Stoner fell. He couldn't even get the bike up. I think he just walked away from it and hung his head. And while we can say that Brno, he fell from a little bit of pressure, it's kind of hard to imagine that was the case here because he got a 3-second lead. Rossi was not matching his pace really. Maybe he was matching for some other sections, but this was only 7 laps and he already had a 3-second lead. It was looking really good, and he honestly can't say what happened. He was just confused. I mean, you could even see him in the video replays when he's in the Ducati garage and he's just shaking his head and throwing up his hands. And he's like, I have no idea what happened. I just fell.
Yeah.
So.
Right. Something. And Hayden did not start this race.
Right.
Qualified 16th.
But then realized that because his qualifying was difficult and his foot was all messed up. That he wanted to save himself for Indy because it was his second. I mean, that's his home round. That's like, you know.
Yeah, it's like 4 hours away from his house.
Yeah, exactly.
3 hours, 4 hours, something like that. And it's the closest distance he's ever driven to a race or something like that.
Right. And it would be anyway.
Right.
So we had Rossi won the race. The big surprise, I think, was Lorenzo at Misano. First time on the MotoGP bike there, obviously. And he took second. He was back on form and got a podium. And then Elias got his second podium in a row.
Yeah.
I think that was his third podium with... Oh, I think he's had podiums before.
Yeah.
But it was the first time I think he had two in a row.
Yeah. And Loretto had, you know, a 3-second gap on Rossi, which at this point in the season was getting to be like, you know, that's a pretty close finish.
You know, Loretto was catching him, actually.
Yeah, I know he was. And he was, but, you know, finishing the race there, you know, the 3 seconds, because I think Rossi went a little bit into relaxation mode
right,
from the last,
right.
you know, just, you know, finish, you know, don't have to push it.
Yep.
And all of that. Yeah. Other significant event, Randy Dupuis was the first crashed out.
Oh, God, what a surprise there.
I know. It was a shocker. And that's at least the second race of the ones we're talking about right here. Where Randy Dupuis was the second or the first guy to crash out. Because he was also first to crash out in Brno, I believe. I'm quickly flipping back through my notes here.
Well, the funnier thing about Dupuis crashing at this one, I think Dupuis finished. I think Dupuis crashed, but
yeah, but he still crashed first.
But he finished. He got back on.
No, it's officially classified to not finish first lap.
In Brno?
No,
in Misano he didn't finish.
Misano,
in Brno,
yeah, he
crashed.
But he
did get the back up and he finished last.
The
thing about Misano was that this was the second year in a row he crashed on the first lap. So he's never finished an entire lap of a race at Misano.
Ever. Never finished a first lap.
Yeah.
Ever. No, that's a little harsh.
So it'll be fun watching what happens next year. He's probably going to be just like crawling.
I know. And it's amazing with Randy Dupuis. You know, you get the shot in the garage of Randy Dupuis sitting there saying, hey, I don't know what happened.
Right,
I crashed again.
Yeah. That's the end. Just the other crasher also crashed to this one.
Yes, but it's good for Grace at Formula One blog, because she gets to see Randy taking his leathers off and a new fan. Dana, and I can't remember her last name, but Dana sent us some emails asking
emailed Bob asking, well, you know, all those, you keep talking about it. Can you just send those over to me?
Yeah. And she told me, she says, I watch the MotoGP races, or I listen to the podcast with my dad, and it's like, oh, great. I'm going to be sending like some teenage girl pictures of Randy Dupuis's chest. No, that's not okay.
That's too funny.
But whatever. Thank you very much, Dana. We did enjoy your emails.
You'll need to send the one with Fergus's head on it.
Yeah, well, that would be awesome. I know I need to get my Photoshop skills going.
Okay, so
Fergus is quite a handsome man.
Oh, yeah.
It doesn't need to be pasted onto Randy Dupuis.
So now that Stoner actually fell again, now we've talked about 75 points, unsurmountable.
Yeah.
Mathematically still possible, but unsurmountable, really.
Realistically, and this is some enormous disaster. Yeah,
Pedrosa finishing fourth meant he was only two points behind Stoner. Suddenly, out of nowhere, Pedrosa, who had missed two rounds, and because of Stoner, you know, not finishing two rounds. You know, they were in contention for that second place, but Rossi was a shoo-in at this point.
Exactly.
I don't think anybody was doubting that he was going to win. Who the hell is going to be able to catch up 75 points on Valentino Rossi?
Unless there's a disaster, you know, and we said that.
But even then, there's other people that might take points from each other, and, you know, so, yeah. You know, it was a done deal.
Yeah.
But we still had.
But all of a sudden, you're right. That Casey Stoner's efforts and chances and whatnot of finishing second are somewhat in danger.
Yeah.
That's right.
And
we know that Danny Pedrosa values second place because he was running the number two plate.
Right. So. And interesting enough, he's going to be running the number three plate.
I know. Yeah. Yeah.
He's the one who told me that, right? Yeah.
Yeah.
He's going wild.
He's going to take advantage of his. Prerogative there that, you know, for the top few finishers, you can run the plate of the number that you're there, but, you know, most people don't do it. But Danny Pedrosa is not above it.
Right.
I can't even remember what his number was.
I don't know why I think that's actually commendable, because it's very old school.
It's old school, and I think in some ways it's the way it should still be.
Marketing attached to guys who run the same plate.
Right.
You know, Rossi claims it's for him, it's a luck thing. And he's an incredibly superstitious guy. You just watch him, like the way he walks up to the bike and does everything exactly the same way every single time. The way he puts on his stickers, apparently. Everything is very, very specific. He's very superstitious. But a lot of other riders are just attached to it through marketing kind of things.
I agree.
You know?
Yeah. And I think with Rossi, I think the marketing enters it as well.
Of course, of course.
You sell a lot of t-shirts and hats and whatnot with a number 46 on them.
There's probably very few countries in which you couldn't find somebody who knew that 46 meant something in motorcycle racing.
Right, right. There's somebody somewhere that is a fan that owns a Rossi shirt and owns a Rossi hat. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so you're right. You're right on that. And I shouldn't bag on Pedrosa too much because it is old school, and I value the old school. I kind of like that.
Yeah.
That it's, you know, when it was a little more pure, when it was a little less about the sponsorship money and all of that.
Right.
You know, it was,
right.
Yeah, back in the day.
But which we'll never see again. But
yeah. But it's still, yeah, it's still a little funny to see Pedrosa. You know, we ran two last year. Now he's going to run three. You know.
Yep.
All right, Indianapolis. Well,
let's go to Indy. It was a hurricane tour, sort of. So, of course, this was second round in the U.S. It's been really built up, obviously, because it's an incredibly famous racetrack. Not exactly, an amazing racetrack, but and actually, even the facilities are kind of just, it's ugly. Architecturally speaking, like it's just an ugly place.
It's functional,
but it's functional and it's actually very functional. I think both you and I were just constantly amazed at how well run the event was.
It was amazingly well run,
especially compared to Laguna Seca, which is kind of
amazing,
crazy. Laguna Seca is like crazy but classic, and I mean obviously Indy is classic, but it is really also very modern. You know, and they really just bling the place out, and they really just a fantastic organization.
And yeah,
I've never been able to get to a race so easily.
Get out of it.
Or get in or out of a racetrack so easily. I mean, it was just brilliant.
Well, I couldn't believe. I still say that you know, on the Sunday, I was thinking, wow, you know, attendance sucks and everything. But, you know, there's 90,000 people there, I think, was the attendance number on Sunday.
Yeah.
And you would not have known it.
Right.
It was just the easiest. Everything was so smooth.
Right, right.
It was really bizarre. But
and the other reason why it was hard to believe was it's so huge.
Yeah, it's freaking huge.
It's really huge.
The other thing, I am a little disappointed in like the food and beer opportunities going on in Indy.
That's true. They could have stepped that up, I think.
Yeah, most of the time, basically, you have to sort of go to the outside of the oval is where a lot of the vendors are. On the infield, there really weren't that many places to get, food or beer.
Right.
And it was a little weird. And plus, the beer choices were Foster's, which is not bad. I can deal with Foster's. Or Miller Lite. You know, not even MGD. Miller Lite. Just in case, you know, you're watching the calories and you want to drink a can of piss, you buy, you know, Miller Lite. It's like, wow. So I was buying Foster's. I remember I brought you back a big old oil can of Foster's. And you're like,
yeah,
ah.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I was like, my God.
How am I going to do with this 40 ounces of beer?
the whole weekend was just really fun because from the moment that I arrived at the airport, I was like, okay, these guys, this is a city that really like breathes racing. I mean,
yes, they
maybe
do.
Most of the racing that they breathe is racing that I don't particularly enjoy. But the
they're
fact
still
that
racing
I
though,
yeah, but I the, exactly. But the fact that I got off the plane and like there's photos of Formula One racing and Indy racing and NASCAR, and there's a big MotoGP signs in the airport.
Yep.
I was just like, okay, this is very different than what I'm used to from Laguna Seca.
The renaming
Sears
of the streets, the putting up the street signs was what
that
got
was,
me.
That was amazing.
That was awesome.
That's right.
That was so cool.
Downtown.
The whole downtown, they put up these, like a street sign, like this is the street name of famous riders. And it was so great.
Yeah, yeah. We had going back to Schwantz and all the great legendary guys, and of course all the especially the Americans.
All the Americans. I mean,
all the Americans. So, you know, and then
Kenny Roberts Jr., there was a bit of a, you know, somebody with a sense of humor put it at the, what was it, the
Hard Life
or something. Cafe or whatever.
Hard Life or something like that, yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, man. Hard Luck.
That was fun, too. That was, yeah. And yeah, actually, Indianapolis is kind of a nice town. I like the way they're downtown, that they kind of, you know,
I've actually, you know, I think I mentioned this when we were covering this. I've actually been at Indy once before, back in the early 90s when I was going cross country to move out to the West Coast. And we actually did a lap of the oval.
Yeah, you did say that in like a freaking Pacer or something like that, right?
An Festiva.
Well, that's a lot different than Pacer.
Yeah. Okay. Come on, man. It's an upgrade. So... So anyway, I actually remember the first time that I was there that it struck me, because I always just figured that if it's in the Midwest, it's going to be lame. But I apologize to all you people out there.
Wow, there you go. Now we're going to get some hate mail. Remember my little Chicago comment once? Yeah. It's in the Midwest. It's lame. Forget it.
No. It's a really fun town. It's actually a lot more fun than like, you have to make fun
Monterey.
Monterey.
I mean, to a point.
I mean, it's the bikers bring the fun to Monterey.
Okay.
Right?
Yeah.
Whereas Indy actually hosts the fun.
Right.
You know what I mean?
I see. The fun is officially sanctioned and it's part of the town. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. I see what you're saying. Yeah.
You can't compare the two. I think Monterey is just so over the top crazy. Bikes lined up on every street, but the people in Monterey kind of they're like, okay, well, we're going to make some money this during this weekend, but they're not really into it. But
they're tolerating you. They're not into it. And I think you could find people in Monterey on MotoGP weekend. You could find quite a few people that didn't realize there was a MotoGP race a few miles away.
Right.
What I'm saying?
Hey, why are all these bikes here?
Tourists. Yeah.
Must be like a Sturgis rally.
Yeah, whereas Indy was not like that. I mean, there was articles in the newspaper. There was those street signs.
That's right.
There was just – it was crazy.
Yep.
And they do. They know how to put on an event, and it's a whole town effort, a whole state effort, I guess.
Yeah.
And I did. I thought that was kind of cool, actually.
It was great.
But about the race, there was a race there.
There was a race there, and it was not a bad race, actually. It was a very interesting race for a lot of reasons. Obviously, one of the reasons was that – we had crazy weather. So, you know, Bob and I were at the track on Friday morning, and it was pouring. It was just pouring rain.
Buckets of rain coming
ridiculous
down.
Ridiculous rain. But, you know, just rain, like proper rain, which means that the bike, that there was no like, if guesswork or anything like that. But by Saturday...
Beautiful
we
day.
Had a completely different day. We had a hot, humid, nasty, you know. Parts of the day were actually perfect.
Yeah.
But there were parts of the day that got really stuffy. And it was like this thunder weather, you know.
You're right. It was a little stuffy. But still, you know, good racing weather. Your track's dry and all of that. Yeah.
No, as far as the racing, for the guys out on the track, was perfect. You know, we walked around the track, pretty much saw every corner that we could see. And you can really – I was very pleasantly surprised that you can actually see as much of the racetrack.
You can see – there's some excellent views. I mean,
really
the
fantastic
seats that
stuff.
We never – that we paid for seats in the – I don't know,
such
somewhere in the stands.
FF11 J stand. Or something like that. Yeah. J, something like
and,
that.
Yeah. We never I actually there. Looked at the track from that spot. I went to our seats one time. And it's amazing how much you can see.
Yeah.
The Jumbotron was, you know, the size of a postage stamp. But, you know, you could see a lot of it. And apparently the North Vista, which is right next to the J stands, is like general admission seating. And you have a great view of the track, you know, bringing binoculars. But other than that, it was kind of cool stuff.
I think anybody in the stands, except maybe the guys sitting. Yeah. Except the people that are sitting like exactly opposite of the pagoda got to see pretty much the entire track from the stands.
Yeah. Right. Exactly. And I walked around Saturday, it was, because in the 250s, we had that horrendous crash in the practice session.
Right, Luthi.
Luthi. And during that time, I was watching that. I was right there when he crashed. And then I ended up walking around the outside thinking, oh, this won't take long. And, oh, my God.
Yeah, an hour later.
Yeah. I finally made it to our little event that we had. Right, because we had a sort of a MotoGPOD meet and greet kind of a thing that went really well. But, yeah, I got there, and I'm just drenched in sweat, and I was dying. It was a long walk.
I know. I made an even bigger mistake. I got out on the outside of the track and walked on the outside, and that was just like miles.
Yeah, that's what I did. But I started up there at the north end and walked all the way around the outside of the track and thinking sooner or later I'm going to find the entrance that I need here. But it was long ways. But no, I had a lot of fun that weekend. It was good stuff. It really was. I mean, other than that, I think our choice of motel, great value.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, very inexpensive. But other than that, it sucked.
It wasn't that bad. I mean,
the motel was fine, but we weren't anywhere near anywhere to eat. We weren't anywhere near
that's true. That's
true. You know, that kind of stuff. Everything was kept right away.
Yep.
Just goes to show you that, you know, maybe, you know, spend a few more bucks, stay at the fancier place. But it was a huge difference, though, in that case, because we got an extraordinary deal on the motel.
Right.
Just like a stupid deal.
Yeah.
Because I think the motel did not realize there was an event that
weekend. It was organized by Michelle.
Right.
Liam's significant other, so like a year before. So anyway, so qualifying went very was interesting because finally Rossi broke Stoner's run on poles and got the pole position. Stoner got second. Lorenzo got third, and then Hayden was fourth. But Hayden really put on a performance. I think that was probably the highlight for me was Hayden's qualifying run. That smoking tire was that last corner, unbelievable.
Yeah,
fun stuff.
Yeah, he did. It was he wanted to do well at this circuit. He really did because it is, you know, it's virtually in his backyard, and there was just so much about this track that was like special for him. He had done that thing on the 1909 motorcycle or whatever.
Yeah, earlier in the year. That's right.
Right.
Yeah. Around. We might as well mention again the first race at Indy was a motorcycle race.
Right. And then they went to these silly cars for 100 years. Yeah. So. But yeah, way, way back in the day. And there is a lot of history at this track. You know, love it or hate it and all of that, but it's the home of American open wheel racing. You know, yes, it's this dumb oval, but I think they did a good job with turning the infield into a good track. You know, the fact that there's no elevation change
is totally flat.
It's totally flat.
Makes for fans get to see a lot more, but I think it makes for kind of a boring
track.
It's a boring track because it's all about just braking and cornering kind of thing.
Right. Especially that first corner complex, that was too slow.
Yeah. I totally
agree. It's a little ridiculous.
It was good for the 125s. Oh, that's the other thing we should mention is that we got to see the 125s and 250s, although the 250 race got canceled, but we did get to see those other classes, which I really think need to come to Laguna. But it doesn't sound like it's going to happen anytime soon. So,
we'll see. But yeah, exactly. You know, on that one, yeah, I know. That's a bummer, too. That really is a bummer that they don't come to Laguna.
Because Laguna would be the perfect track for those bikes.
That would be awesome to watch that. I know. It would be fantastic.
It's such a perfect place for small displacement motorcycles.
Yeah.
Anyway, so we had crazy rain day one. Beautiful sunny weather, but got a little stuffy. It looked kind of like something was up in the air. I know I have this like kind of a photo journal of the skies, you know,
mm-hmm.
And definitely says something iffy was going on. And then Sunday arrives and we had the 125 race in the rain. It got shortened because of the rain. Then by the time the 250 race arrived, you and I and who was with us over there? We were standing because we were on the
turn 9 grandstands for the the start of the 250 race that did not happen.
Right, right.
No, but and before, then we went over that, to the, like, the we medical shack.
In the 125s, during the 125s, when the outside, on the outside of the infield. And I remember looking north and like the clouds were going to the right. Then I look, you know, then I look east and the clouds are going to the right. And I look south and the clouds are going to the right. And I look west and the clouds are going to the right. I'm like, shit, we're in the freaking hurricane. Of course, yeah. This is, you know, Hurricane Ike, which did some serious damage in, down in Texas a few days earlier and made it up to here and still was doing damage. So we got windy and rainy and crazy. I mean, I've never seen anything like it. I mean, we were staying in turn nine on the inside for the 250 race, and there were those boards. Remember those boards that were
blowing away?
Like the city boards, city boards.
That was the MotoGP race that they were fixing those.
You're right. Because before that, we were staying there. It started pouring. It was windy, and they just said, "Okay, well, the 250 race is being delayed till after the MotoGP race." So we went and hung out with some medical guy, equipment, medical emergency teams
in a place we weren't supposed to be. Right.
We were there for like an hour waiting, and then we were like, "There's no way they're going to run the MotoGP race," but we had. And then they brought out those crazy jet engine trucks that actually managed to blow the water out of off the racetrack, and they did an extra set of sighting laps. I think they did two. They did a sighting lap. And then they did a warm up lap, and it looked good.
Yeah,
they did it, and the weather kind of like still. It was almost like we were in the eye of the storm. I think we actually were in the eye of the storm, the remains of that storm, because the race started fairly, you know, I mean, it was damp and
right.
It was some pockets of water, which were definitely dangerous, but it was great. And then, you know, first lap we saw, Dovizioso leading the race, which was the first time he has ever led a race.
Yes. Yes.
And he managed to officially make the lap. So he was leading at the beginning of lap two, but then he got overtaken by Hayden, who then started making some distance, and Hayden really looked extremely good.
Right.
Rossi came through the field and started chasing down Hayden and eventually caught him and beat him.
Yeah. In a nutshell, that was it. Yeah.
Yeah. It was painful to watch just how much Hayden's pace fell off at the end, because his tire just he was on a intermediate tire, a little too soft, I think, and he just used up a lot of it. When the rain started coming back in, he just had no tread left.
Right.
So Lorenzo almost caught him.
The race was called a little early.
Yeah, it was called on the lap 16, eight laps from the end. Which is exactly the precise moment at which race direction can decide to call the race.
It was lap 20, sorry, on this one. It's lap 16 for the 125s.
Oh, you're right. I'm sorry. Yep.
But that's whatever. They same thing. They did. That was they called it as like, you know, let's finish this, and then they called it. And had the race not been called. Nikki Hayden would not have gotten second.
No, there's no way. Lorenzo was totally on
it. Lorenzo was totally
almost passed him that lap, actually, right. That last lap. He managed to keep him off, and then, there was no doubt that Lorenzo was going to pass him.
Yeah.
So there was a little bit of confusion at the end, because we were standing up on top of the pagoda, the section next to the pagoda, the top of the paddock, and we were, you know, and it was like Rossi won. No, wait, they're gonna go back out. No,
right, and right. They went into the pits thinking they were gonna be going back out.
Right. And even you know, talking to Liam and other teams, nobody really knew what was going on. So it was a very weird situation. Actually, the first time that I remember since I've ever. I don't remember if it's ever happened before that the race was in this kind of state where like you didn't really know whether it was called or not.
Right. And I'm not sure where that breakdown, why that occurred, where that occurred, what caused that. But there was a somewhat of a breakdown in communication
there. Oh, well, I think that there was a required amount of time to wait for the conditions to get better. The conditions were just atrocious, and it wasn't the wind. I mean, it wasn't the rain, it was the wind. And there's some incredible footage from those last few laps where you see just branches and stuff flying across at turn 10 at the end of that back straight. It was just looking really dangerous. So I think that the race direction did the right thing. And of course, immediately after they called the race, the sun came out, but it remained very windy. So windy that the 250 race ended up getting called.
Right. And we were down in the paddock watching the little barriers that they had set up. There's like a sort of a temporary fence with tarps.
Right.
It's all blowing over and everything, yes. And they're coming out. But again, this is an example of how well Indy runs an event. You know, I mean, they were on it. You know, they're coming out, and there's this team of guys fixing that fence and stuff like that. And there was that puddle at the bridge. And,
right.
It was turning all swampy. And, I mean, Laguna Seca, that puddle would have been left, and it would have got worse and worse and worse.
Would have been
there
the next year.
Yeah. And, at Indy, they come out, some guy trundling out with a four-wheel ATV thing with a trailer full of wood chips and starts filling up the puddle.
Right, right. Yeah, they're ready for anything over there.
Yeah, it was neat.
Stoner never really figured in this race, but he did finish fourth. Pedrosa had a miserable time out there. This is the only race, by the way, the entire calendar where everybody finished. Considering the conditions, it was remarkable.
A bit of a shocker, yes, exactly.
Although if it went the whole way, maybe somebody would crash. But yeah, we had all 19 riders finish, and all 19 riders were present and finished.
Yeah.
But Pedrosa finished eighth, so this was pretty much... It didn't kill his chances for second place by any means, but I think any hope he had. This was his first race at the Bridgestone. That's right. Mm-hmm. So actually, eighth wasn't really a bad thing.
No, considering the weather and everything, this race is such an anomaly, weird one. Yeah. So
Spies did good. We had Spies finish sixth.
Spies finished. Sorry, sixth.
And that meant that. He had the two rounds that he had some experience at, because obviously he's raced at Laguna Seca before, and at Indy, he had that test session that he was able to test the bike there. So it really paid off for him. I think he had for his three rides, getting 20 points is pretty good.
I agree. Yeah, I think he did quite well.
All that's worth talking about at this point about Indy. It was crazy, crazy weekend because of the weather.
And we're running extremely long on this call, so I think we should probably call it a day on that and say that we'll be back next week to finish up the season.
Okay, yeah. At this point, Rossi was leading 87 points. It was just getting ridiculous. It's important to know that he, by winning in Indianapolis, he had beaten Giacomo's Agostini's...
number of wins in the premier class, right?
Premier class wins, yeah.
Which he was not happy about. Yeah.
So. Right.
Right on. Let's call it a day. So
okay.
Talk to you next day. Week.
Yeah.
Right on.
Thanks. Ciao.
Bye. That's going to do it for today's show. I hope you enjoyed it. Thanks for being patient through the length of it, an hour and a half. It's a fairly long podcast, but I think that the call was pretty good. Jules and I had a good time doing it, and I hope you had a good time listening to it. And next week, we will come back for the last few rounds of the MotoGP 2008 season, which was Japan. And my memory is failing me, but we went to Japan. And then I know that Malaysia, Australia, and Valencia. So, or maybe it was Japan, Australia, Malaysia, Valencia. Yeah, that was the order of it. So in any case, we'll talk about those last four races of the 2008 season next week. And until then, I hope your weather is kind of improving a little bit. And so you can get out there and ride and keep the shiny set up and the riverside down. And we'll talk again next week.
Oh,
geez, got the tape in there backwards here. One more time. MotoGP OD is produced by Bob Hayes, and I'm solely responsible for its content. MotoGP is a trademark of Dorna Sports SL. The MotoGP OD podcast and MotoGPOD.com are not affiliated with Dorna Sports SL. All other trademarks are the property of their respective owners, and MotoGP OD is not affiliated with any of them.